If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
And it was never the goal to make gobs of money. It was a goal, if you would, a quest to make great wine.
And it's the same team, you know, treating every tank and every wine with the same respect. And, you know, same barrel sourcing, same, you know, I help my clients out with finding glass and corks and labels, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's all in the family to me.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 476. This week we feature Ben Jordan, winemaker at Early Mountain Vineyards in Madison, Virginia. Taking notice of wines in various parts of the United States is paying big dividends to wine lovers. Virginia is an area that has achieved notice in fine wine offerings. I spoke with Ben Jordan, winemaker for Early Mountain Vineyards in Madison, Virginia, just a couple of weeks ago, and have once again had my eyes opened to the diversity of our country. And so, Virginia is for wine, too. You can also hear Ben on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the phrase, progress past nostalgia. Well, today we're back to an interview with a winemaker in Virginia, which is really cool. I'm on the phone with Ben Jordan. Ben is the winemaker at Early Mountain Vineyards. How are you doing, Ben?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. Virginia is a, you know, it's, I don't want to call it an up-and-comer. It's an area that's got some history behind it with wine. So let's talk about the area that you make wine in. Where are you in the state of Virginia?
So we're in Madison, Virginia, which is just kind of the northern part of what we would call Central Virginia. There's, you know, kind of two areas where wine is concentrated. There's Central Virginia around Charlottesville, Albemarle County, and then Northern Virginia. And so if you want to place us kind of relative to those two places, we're kind of in the middle. So we either Northern Central Virginia or Southern Northern Virginia.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, it's a uniquely shaped state, too, so that kind of makes a difference.
Right.
Are you in, I'm assuming you're in a mountainous area, or is that not correct?
Yeah, so the winery itself is situated in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, so just to the east of the Blue Ridge Mountains, which runs kind of southwest to northeast through the state. And then we work with, we farm a vineyard on the side of the Blue Ridge called Quaker Run, which we'll talk a little bit about later, I think. And then we also work with some really cool vineyards in other parts of the state, specifically other mountainside vineyards north of us on the Blue Ridge, and then a couple of vineyards in the Shenandoah Valley that are up on ridges in the valley.
Good. So there's some variance going on there. You know, this is just such a typical question, but I'm going to ask it. We talked a little bit a minute ago. What makes Virginia wine unique?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's one that we can answer in a lot of different ways. But I think the most important thing to point out, which is obvious, but it's really important to Virginia, is the fact that we're part of this East Coast wine-growing region growth. So folks have been trying to make wine on the East Coast for hundreds of years and, you know, to varying levels of success. But between the climate, which is more challenging because there's more rain than, say, California, Oregon, or Washington, and the fact that Prohibition happened, especially in Virginia, we're talking about the modern industry is a product of the past few decades. So, you know, really 30 or 40 years old in terms of what we're doing now. And so it's a young region. It's a region that is still emerging. It is a region that is going to look very different in 20 years than it does now. And it looks very different now than it did 20 years ago. And so all of that is to say that it's an exciting place to be for folks that want to be part of building a foundation, that want to be part of an industry that has a future that is, you know, less stable than even what we call the New World, but a place like California, but certainly Europe or places where wine growing has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Sure. I'm almost surprised there's not a category called the New World, you know, and maybe there is, and I'm not aware of it. Who knows?
Yeah, we are definitely the new.
Yeah. Well, maybe we just coined it. Who knows? You just made an interesting comment about what it'll look like in 20 years. What is your vision for that?
Yeah, I can't say that I know exactly, but what I do know is that, well, to take a step back, one thing that Virginia has been very good at is understanding that it's a big state, and we have, you know, not only diverse microclimates, but diverse elevations, diverse geology, diverse aspects, also all sorts of things. And so we cannot be a one grape fits all place. So we can't just hang our hats on one name brand grape variety. We have to have diversity in the grapes that we plant. And because of that, it's kind of freed us to also embrace grapes that maybe folks haven't heard of. And that helps because as we try to find grapes that work in our climate, you know, we have a decent amount of rain and some humidity, then it's not necessarily going to be the name brand grapes that work in California or Oregon. So because of that, we've made a name for ourselves for being able to sell wines to our consumers that are different, they may not have heard of before they walked into our door. And that will continue in the future. And so I think there's new grapes to be understood by us as wine growers and, you know, new places in the state as well. So it could be very different. I think you'll see some of the grapes that we have now will still be quite important. And certainly some of the places that we grow grapes will be very important. But there'll be, you know, not to put a number on it, probably a 50% change in the types of grapes that we grow. And I think what won't change is that we are, because of our landscape, you're not going to see us be such an intensely viticultural region as, say, Bordeaux or, you know, parts of California where every square, you know, every acre is planted with grapes. You're sure. Always going to see diversity in our agriculture, and you'll see as more development happens of vineyard land in Virginia, it'll be on, you know, looking for the right place to plant grapes. And not to harp on the challenging climate, but there are challenges that can be overcome by the sites themselves. And the more we learn about how to make a good site for growing grapes in the Virginia, the more you'll see folks going out and developing those sites. So I think there'll be different grapes, and there'll be a lot more kind of exciting vineyards that have been planted Sure. Over the next 20 years.
Sure, I'll bet. Let's talk about those grapes. Are these hybrids? Are these cold weather grapes? What are the grapes you're talking about locally?
Yeah, so cold weather is not as much of a challenge for us as, say, up in New York or Vermont, unless you're up above 2,000 feet, 2,500 feet, of which you are seeing people start to plant at those elevations and produce very different wines, which is exciting in itself. But if you look at mostly where we're planted now, which is, you know, this kind of foothills area east of the Blue Ridge, especially both in central and northern Virginia and other parts of the state, and even in most of the Shenandoah Valley, cold winters, they can have an effect, but they're not our main concern. Mm. The main concern is grapes having thick enough skin to be able to hang long enough to achieve ripeness and ripening at the right time. So hybrids have always been important to the industry. They make it easier to farm. I think the word hybrid is a relatively generic one because it encompasses basically every grape that's ever been bred across species from, you know, 300 years ago until now. And the way people are breeding grapes now is very different than they were 300 years ago and for different goals and purposes. So I think certainly you'll see a new wave of hybrids that are high vinifera parentage will be important to the industry. But in terms of vinifera, Vitis vinifera themselves, the grapes right now that are important are, you know, certainly the Bordeaux varieties, Merlot, Cabernet Franc. Cabernet Sauvignon is more challenging. There's a few people that do it, but certainly Petit Verdot, all important. Malbec, not as important. And then, you know, Chardonnay is planted everywhere around the world and is an important grape variety here as well. But other whites that are becoming more important are Petit Bensang, especially, which is near and dear to us, but even Sauvignon Blanc, Albarino, some aromatic whites seem to do well. And then in terms of, you know, some other grapes that folks may not be as familiar with, Tannat in certain places seems important, Blanc Francais in other places maybe getting some traction. But like I say, we can't predict exactly what the grapes will be as we move forward, but just that there will be more and different.
Sure. That makes sense. So let's talk about your particular wine journey. As I read, you are a native Virginian, correct?
Yeah, I was born in the Shenandoah Valley, grew up west of Stanton, if you know the geography there at all, but basically right up against the Western Mountains, right before you head into the Alleghenies and Appalachians.
So it's fair to say you were grown in the Shenandoah Valley. Sorry, I had to say that.
Yep.
Okay. So your wine journey, you know, everybody's always got an interesting story. Did you have an aha moment? Did you have some kind of a wine background? How did you come to become a winemaker?
Yeah, it's definitely circuitous, if anything. I graduated college, went out to San Francisco, was a bike messenger and trying to be a playwright. Went to grad school in Pittsburgh for playwriting. Moved to New York because that's what you do as a playwright.
Sure.
And kind of hit wine there because I needed a job that would pay me, and started selling wine retail. Had started having aha moments at that point because I had a couple of important mentors and we were in New York and just had the world of wine, you know, coming to that city. Then moved back out to San Francisco, worked for a wine importer, and at that point got to know winemakers up in Sonoma County. And kind of at the same time, my family was starting to experimentally plant on some land in the Shenandoah Valley that we had, and understood that it might be good for me to start to learn how to make the stuff if we were going to be making those sorts of moves. So worked harvest in the Russian River Valley, got lucky, got hired to work kind of half lab, half cellar, which was very foundational for my understanding of winemaking. And then spent, you know, 4 years learning winemaking in California before coming back to Virginia, which was always the goal once I got into the production side of things, was to come back and be part of something new and emerging. And landed at with Michael Schaps at his Wineworks facility, which is partially a facility for his wines, but also what is effectively custom crush for various clients throughout the state. So really got a boot camp in Virginia grapes, Virginia wine from all over the state pretty quickly working for him. And then transitioned over, got the call from Early Mountain in 2015 to come basically oversee winemaking in vineyards here, and have been working on that with the team here. And it's, you know, it's very much a team effort. So not just me, we have a great team that both grows and makes wine.
Great people behind a great winemaker. It's kind of how it goes. If you don't mind me asking, who was the first winery you worked for in Sonoma?
The first winery was called C. Donatello, which is Russian River Pinot and Chardonnay. I think they no longer exist. And then it was Dutcher Crossing, which is up in Dry Creek.
Yeah.
But both small kind of boutique places.
I asked more personally because I know Chris.
Oh, cool.
What year was that again?
Started in 2008.
Okay. Just because Chris took over what was the Belvedere Winery.
Right.
I forgot what year that was, which was one of my absolute favorite wines in Sonoma. The winery itself, Early Mountain, where did that name come from?
It has to do with a fellow named Joseph Early, who figures into kind of Revolutionary War time. So basically an owner of the property way back in the day. And there is a story that George Washington was entertained by the family at some point back then. And so, you know, part of it is the fact that we're basically at the mountains. So mountain is important to the name, but also going back to this Early family and their hospitality and us kind of carrying on the ideas of hospitality. But the Early name you'll see around this part of Virginia, it was a family that had ties to a lot of the area around here.
Oh, well, it's good to have a story attached to it, that's for sure. Cool. Now, as I understand it, Gene Case is the owner of the winery, correct?
Correct, yes.
And starting a winery is a great challenge because the cost, the involvement, you know, you plant your first vineyard, you've got such a long time to you're actually bringing any money in. How did she start the winery?
Yeah, well, I think Gene and Steve are both wine lovers, and, you know, I think they had kind of a similar, and they're based in Virginia, so that's a big part of it, but they'd had a similar kind of journey to Virginia wine as many did, which was, you know, back in the early days, there were couple bright stars, but it was, you know, there was some hit and miss quality across the state. But at a certain point in probably the mid to late aughts, they were really noticing this kind of change in quality and this seriousness that was coming that, you know, had to do with just everyone learning from previous experience, but also the kind of momentum you get from once you start hiring expertise, a lot of imported expertise from Europe and from California. Once you get that expertise in place and they start learning the lay of the land, then there becomes this kind of perpetuating cycle of improvement. And that really kind of snowballed and momentum was building and it was starting to show in the wines for sure. And so a number of folks that have become excited about Virginia wine, I think in the past, 10, 15 years, they got excited about the idea of being a part of the industry and bringing sort of their ethos and abilities to fund a project that is ambitious. And so they basically were looking around for opportunities and found Early Mountain, which at that time was called Sweely and had been planted. A winery was built and the hospitality space was built, but definitely needed some work. And so they rehabilitated it and, invested a lot, added a lot, and then started looking for new opportunities in terms of vineyards. And that's where Quaker Run and our other relationships with growers in other parts of the state have come about. So it's been this kind of evolution and this progress that that started with excitement.
Very cool. Now, you'd mentioned Chardonnay before. Do you get into any sparkling at all?
We do. And so, I mentioned this being very much a team effort. Maya Hood White, who her title is Associate Winemaker and Viticulturalist, was first our vineyard manager here, but I'd always been, educated in winemaking. She went to Davis and wanted to be in winemaking, and so really worked to transition into the winery with me. That has been one of her roles, is building the sparkling program. So she started with PetNat and has been building the traditional method program as well, which obviously takes a lot longer than PetNat. But we're at a point now where we have wine we can offer that is based on this work, and it's really progressing nicely.
Yeah, I'd be very curious to try a sparkling wine or a PetNat from there. And you're also well known for your rosés, is that correct?
Yes. So rosé has been important to us for a variety of reasons. I think the first thing is that so we have these blocks that are around the winery at the Early Mountain site, we'll call it, which is in Madison, Virginia. And they're planted on, heavier clay soils, which, I think would be great soils for bigger reds in, say, California, where you need water because water is scarce. But in Virginia, they hold water a little bit too much. So trying to ripen big, heavy reds is a challenge for these red grapes that are planted here. So we tried. We gave it a go for a few years. We just realized that it was really round peg, square hole. Trying to make them into big Bordeaux reds was not appropriate. So we changed our focus and realized that they were perfect for rosé because the soils actually delayed ripening a little bit so that we could be picking them not in the heat of the summer, and they still had good acid. So we pick at lower alcohol levels, higher acid levels, farm for rosé, pick for rosé. And kind of at that same time, rosé was really hitting its stride in the world. And so the demand for rosé has, I think people keep saying it's going to drop off, but we haven't seen that. And so it's just really helped us that we can use these blocks for the appropriate wine. We have nice, hot, humid summers here. It is the perfect wine to deal with that, and allows us to work with Quaker Run and our other sites for our more ageable red wines.
Well, I think rosé has always been a very approachable wine for a lot of people. I mean, even back to the days of White Zinfandel, which was a starting point for many, many people. So I think it's kind of come into its own these days. What are you making the rosé from? What grape?
So it's usually based in Merlot, but almost always based in Bordeaux varieties. And then it's kind of dependent on the vintage and then, some of our intuition and ideas, how the rest of it goes. Cabernet Franc has become more and more important. And then actually kind of counterintuitively, early picked Petit Verdot we use because it brings really good acidity when it's picked early, has like a very kind of citrus floral thing, and then helps with the color as Petit Verdot does.
I'm curious about the properties you're farming combined with the labor question. Obviously, many businesses in this country right now are dealing with labor shortages. Labor hasn't been easy the last few years in the wine industry. So kind of a two-part question is, how is labor going for you guys? And do you do any mechanical harvesting there?
Yes, I'll answer the mechanical harvesting question first. We do not do any of it. The vineyard wasn't designed for it, and the landscape's not overly homogenous, so we just don't do it. And in a lot of our winemaking, we do a lot of whole cluster pressing of white that makes that approach to winemaking challenging because it's just doing it in the field. In terms of the labor, we were lucky that Jean put her foot down that we really needed to understand our labor and have it be consistent. And so we were kind of early adopters for Virginia for the H2A program, which allows you to, bring in labor from outside the country. And even more, we've been lucky that we've been able to bring the same people back year after year. We work really hard to treat them well and, go above and beyond the standards that the visa program sets so that they're, happy working here with us. So that has been extremely important to working where every vintage is different, and you want to be able to have the flexibility and just be able to be very nuanced in the vineyard. So having a long-term team is extremely important to that.
Certainly, absolutely. A little bit of security for when harvest comes along. You know, one thing I wanted to ask and I haven't gotten to, and that is how many cases are you making?
Yeah, so that's a changing number every year. We're still in a growth pattern. So this year looks like we made around 16,000 cases. We always reserve the right to bulk a certain percentage of our production out to help improve the quality of our blending. And so, you know, we're somewhere between 16 and 17,000 you know, 9-liter case equivalents of bulk wine produced from the vintage. How much we bottle has yet to be determined, but it's probably somewhere between, you know, 14 and 15.
Every year, wineries normally will hold some wine back because they'll keep it for the future or for their wine club or just posterity in general. I assume you do that. How much wine do you normally put to the size? When you're a small winery, that's, you know, that's a real concern.
Yeah, and it's one of the biggest challenges because you look to a established place that's been around making high quality wine for a long time, like Barbersville, and they have these amazing libraries of their wines, and it's so cool to be able to taste one of their 20-year-old wines to, you know, prove what Virginia wine can do. But, you know, there's both the demand from consumers and from the bottom line that requires the sales of wine, so we have to balance that. But what we've really kind of aligned on is librarying certain wines that we know will be the most ageable and that we can really, you know, bring out in verticals and bring out for customers that love us, especially this time of year. So that what that really means is a wine called Alluvium, which is a Bordeaux-style blend based in Merlot, Rise, which is our top wine that we only make in the best vintages, and then kind of selective librarying of some of the single vineyard stuff, like the Quaker Run Chardonnay and Cabernet Franc, and then Petit Manseng, which is a really important wine for us just because that grape is important to us.
Nice. Well, as a winemaker, I'm sure you get advice from all kinds of places, all kinds of people, but as a professional, what's the most unusual advice you've ever been given?
You know, it doesn't seem unusual to me now because I talk about it all the time, but it has to do with Petit Manseng. And when I was working at Wineworks with Michael Schaps, one day we were looking at our, you know, it was middle harvest, trying to figure out what to pick, knew we couldn't pick everything. There was rain coming, and he pointed to, you know, this block of Petit Manseng. It's like, we can just let that hang. It's probably good if it gets rained on anyway. Which is not the kind of thing that you hear.
No, not too often.
Winemakers say.
Yeah.
It's always like, get that before the rain. And the thing is that Petit Manseng has this intensity of both acid, but also, you know, sugar ripeness. So it can get into kind of uncomfortable potential alcohol levels quickly in drought or, you know, heat wave conditions. And so if any grape can handle rain, it's Petit Manseng. And sometimes Petit Manseng wants to get rained on because it helps moderate that kind of alcoholic power. And it's something I like to point to with that grape, and just like to say it out loud because it always throws people off. But the other thing that it does is allows you to pick something, you know, the day after it rains when pretty much everything else is, you're waiting for it to dry out. So it is a logistically important sort of philosophy as well.
Yeah, definitely not the kind of advice you'd expect to hear from another winemaker.
Yeah.
This could go positive or negative. What makes you crazy about the wine business?
I think it's both what I love about it, but because of the way it is, it can make me crazy sometimes. Just we have such sheer diversity in our products in this industry. You know, we have kind of very large production wines that are made by large wineries that are very consistent and, you know, are brands that you can count on. But like in the boutique world, of which I would still very much count us in, there's such diversity, not just of grapes not just of regions, but of styles and approaches and all of that. And that is what, you know, when I was selling wine, I was a lover of wine. I fell for it. And that's what got me, and that's what gets people. But because there's so much out there, it becomes easy to shorthand stuff. And we start putting stuff in boxes, and, you know, you have to do that, but humans do that to get through a day in their life. But it can cause issues when we're talking about things and trying to, like, really draw lines between the way people work and just saying it's one or the other is a problem. But I guess that's just also gives me something to work towards every day. So it can cause me angst.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of angst when you're a winemaker, when you get right down to it, especially when it comes to things like Mother Nature, that sort of thing.
For sure.
Interesting. Somebody said to me a while ago, a winemaker in the Finger Lakes region said to me, you don't often meet a former winemaker. I laughed at that and I thought, you know, I can't think of one.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's kind of, I mean, you meet people that dabbled, that worked to harvest or, you know, maybe even spent a year or two in a winery before they decided it wasn't right for them. But yeah, once people get to, you know, they work their way up, put in their time, then it's kind of hard to think they're doing something else.
Yeah, I think you become thoroughly indoctrinated, infected, whatever you want to call it. So, well, we've come to the point of the interview now where I ask my favorite question, and that is, I'm sure you've done plenty of interviews, plenty of media. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Let me see. That's a tough one. Let me just... it definitely has to do with Virginia and the future of Virginia. Okay. Something along the lines of, okay, you know, this person is saying this, here's the person. You know, I walk through the forests of Virginia and there are grapevines in the trees everywhere. So why do people question the ability to grow grapes in Virginia? That would tee me up well to go on a nice
a nice tangent,
a nice discussion.
So why is that? I mean,
it's not to get into what we're talking about a little bit later, but I think it has to do with this idea of looking like really kind of giving too much preference to the past, to the kind of, you know, the European culture of wine. And while that is extremely important to the way wine has developed and, you know, where we are today, it is also important to remember that wine is really just a fruit that the sugars have been fermented into alcohol. And grapes happen to be one of the best fruits to do that with. But European grapes are not the only grapes in the world. There's grapes all over the place, and it's more a question of focus. The European and, you know, Middle Eastern grape varieties, there's been a long-term focus on getting them into shape through breeding, through selection of you know, new vines that are good for producing wine. And so that's, you know, it makes sense that they're in a good place with that, but that doesn't mean you should write off all the kind of grapevines that have been growing up in their respective regions, that they'll never be able to make good wine. Sure, they don't in their kind of wild state, but they haven't been, you know, they haven't been farmed, they haven't been cultivated and crossed and found. The work hasn't been done. The same work that has been done on Vitis vinifera has not been done on all these other grapevines across the world. And so to put this bias in place is really just kind of looking at the past instead of into the future.
Very good answer. Very good. Obviously, you have a tasting room. Is it by appointment? Can people just wander on in? What is the status of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think like most businesses with a tasting room, the pandemic pandemic has changed things. So where we didn't, you know, appointments weren't really a big part of our business before, they're pretty important now. And I think they're important to our customers in that, one, you know, you can get yourself a table, but also, you know, knowing that you should get an appointment on busy days, or you could find yourself not able to do a tasting or have a flight or something like that. So, but there is walk-in, there are abilities to walk in, but it's always good to, if you're planning, especially if you're planning on coming from a distance, just make an appointment. It's a lot better chance of getting the right enjoyment out of it. But we also have a restaurant with a, you know, really good team, chef who came over from the end of Washington, has really kind of elevated our food offerings. And so it's a really nice place to spend, not just to taste a few wines, but to really spend some time, relax, have a meal, taste a flight. And you know, as opposed to bar tastings, we're a lot more into like curated flights and those sorts of things. So I think experientially, it's a great place to come to. But yeah, you should check and see if you can make an appointment if you can.
Excellent. And for our listeners who'd like to learn about you online, what is your website?
Earlymountain.com.
Ben, this is fun. This is, I think, only our second interview with a winemaker in Virginia, so I'm excited to learn more about Virginia wines. Thank you very much for your time. I sincerely do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Always fun to talk.
Learn more by visiting earlymountain.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Geisha. Our intern is Clement Maddox. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.